tape of the interview with John Hendricks, and we have the family now in Seattle, reunited with their father. And can you describe what the property looked like when you arrived at the property your father had bought?
Well, it was an old house that had been vacant for a couple of years since the owner had died, and his widow sold it. And so my dad had spent a few months in his spare time trying to get it back in shape. So it was livable. It wasn't anything fancy. There was no electricity. In other words, it had never been wired. So we had kerosene lights and lamps. And that's the first time we'd really seen kerosene, because in Norway we had all the electric lights we wanted. But we had that, and wood stoves and for heat, and it was mostly the stove in the kitchen heated the whole house. And but it was I guess it was comfortable. We got along all right.
Was it a lot of property?
There was 25 acres of land and an old barn building, and we had a couple of, Dad had bought a couple of cows, so we got some milk. We didn't have, he hadn't had much of a garden that first year, but the neighbors, they still had enough potatoes, so we got all the potatoes, and they must have known we were coming, because they'd canned enough vegetables, so the neighbors had, so we got along fine.
And did you go to school immediately?
Well, we came here on the 19th of December, and we started school right after the Christmas holidays, and we started in the grade school in Olala, and of course, couldn't speak a word of English, and there was almost four of us that went to school. My oldest brother had already, he didn't start school at that time. He did go to the grade school in that fall. He went just to help learn a little bit of language, but he'd been through the eighth grade when he left Norway. But the other two, they went through the grades. Actually, I started in the first grade in spring of 31, and went through the grades. And in spring of 39, I graduated from high school.
Was it very hard not knowing English and going to an American school?
Well, you know, kids, when you get together with other kids, I think they learn pretty fast. I don't think we had any trouble. I learned to speak English within a matter of a couple of months. I was able to get along with almost anybody. I may not be very good at English, probably not now even. In my 80s, and I still ain't very good at English, but but I was able to learn enough English to get along.
And the children that you went to school with, were they immigrant children or mostly American-born children? Or?
They were mostly American in the grade school, but they were a lot of them were of Scandinavian, you know. As a matter of fact, a couple of them, their parents were from the same place in Norway that we were. But the kids that went to school were born in this country, but their parents were born in the same place.
And did you all get along together pretty well in school?
Oh yeah, we didn't. There was no problem. Everybody, in the 30s, people got along pretty well out in the country. anybody needed help, the neighbors would help them out. And those same people that needed help, they'd come and help you when you needed it.
And what kind of work was your father doing at this point?
Well, at this point, it was between fishing season, so he was working around the farm, you know, trying to get that in shape. It must have been around March of the first year we were here. He had to take off and go up to Alaska and go fishing again, you know. So,
why did he have to go all the way up to Alaska?
Well, that's where the halibut fishing is. He got on boat here in Seattle, and the boat went to Alaska, and they would bring the fish back to Seattle to sell. In other words, they would go up and catch a boatload and bring it back to Seattle and go back up again.
How long would one of these trips take?
Well, it'd take about 3 weeks in the trip, but sometimes they would sell the fish in Alaska, then keep on the fishing. So that first year, I think he only came to Seattle once or twice in the middle of the season till it was over. And at that time, the season lasted up till end of November.
And when did it begin?
In March. So, a long season.
And what did your mother do on the farm?
Well, with the five kids, she'd take care of the house and do the cooking for us kids. And by that time, my oldest brother and we're all big enough. We had to go. We took care of the livestock, and we did the went out in the garden, did the outside work. And mother was out doing her share too, but we all had to chip in. Nobody sat home and played when there was work to be done.
And did your father learn English on his first two trips to America?
Well, on the first, yes, he learned English.
And did your mother pick up English also?
Well, she picked up because us kids probably taught her most of the English. And of course, she got out in the country and she wasn't shy. She was outgoing. She wanted to associate with people, so she got on with the neighbors, women.
Playing cards.
Playing cards, or church group, or they just had get together with coffee, at ladies' aid in church and things like that. And she was able to talk. She learned enough English to get along.
And did your parents, when they were in your home, did they speak English to each other, or did they still continue to talk Norwegian?
Well, the first year or two was mostly Norwegian, but gradually it got to be more English. Mm-hmm. And I know by the time time I was in high school, it was they were talking mostly English to each other.
And you had one brother who was born in the United States?
Yeah, he was born here in Ballard, actually. Yeah, he was born in 1935, he was born.
So what year did you graduate
From primary school in 35, I left the grade. Yeah, spring of 35, I was through the eighth grade. And then in May of 39, I graduated from high school. Mm-hmm. And then I went up to Alaska, I did a little fishing up in Alaska. I came back, and I worked downtown Seattle in the clothing store. I was a salesman. Fisherman's Outfitting Store. Then I got a call from the Navy to go to work serving an apprenticeship, and I went in to Bremerton Navy Yard.
Is that near here?
That's across the sound here, yes. That's about, just about 15 miles north of where we were living out there, but and it's across the sound here, and that's a big naval shipyard.
And that was during the war years?
Well, it was, it was 1941. The war hadn't started here. It didn't start here till. But I went to work there, served my apprenticeship as an electrician, and until 1944. And the draft board had to fill the quota, so they told me to go in to check out, you know. And I figured, no big deal, just go. And right now I was classifying, occupational deferment, because, you know, I was working for the Navy Yard. I said, I'll just went there to the draft board and then I'll get reclassified, go back to work. No, I walked in, I figured, I'll go in before ref, you know, that's physical disability. I walked in on my own 2 feet and says, you can walk in, you're in the Army. I wasn't really in the Army, because I could fill the quota. So then I had a couple of weeks to make arrangement. I arranged to join the Navy. So I joined the Navy, and they were going to send me to Northwestern University in Chicago for a year and a half, electronics. And I went back to Great Lakes Naval Training Station and got there on a Saturday morning. They didn't do anything till Monday morning. And they ran us through the processing, the physical, and the flunk, and they says, you're getting a discharge. I was there, I'd been in there 2 days. In the meantime, I'd bought some property. My wife and I had bought some property. I did it after I was told I was going, you know, this call from the draft board. I figured out that's no big deal. I was going to be there. Well, I put the property up for sale, sold some of the, I figured, if I'm in for the duration. You know, some things that you couldn't buy, like washing machines. You couldn't buy a washing machine for anything, you know, during the war. You'd buy a used one if you could find it. Well, we had a fairly good one. Somebody needed it, and I didn't see much sense in storing it for the duration of the war because I had no place else to put it. So I sold that 2 days later. Like a discharge. So I said, the heck with it, and I came back from from there, and went back to my job in the Navy Yard, and it was quite a deal, because all the time when you're working for the on civil service, sometimes there some of the higher ups are envious of their jobs, you know, and you do this and that. And they had it during the war. They said, you behave or we'll tell the draft board, you know. So I called the draft board when I came out. I was free to do what I wanted. In other words, you were frozen to your jobs, everybody else. I was free to go where I wanted. In other words, they wouldn't. Of course, I mean, I was free to go if somebody would hire me, but I mean, they couldn't hold it against me, so. I went back in the Navy Yard anyway, I went to work. And when I went back to work, they had a classification at that time, I don't know whether they still do. They give you rate, the ones that served their apprenticeship, they give them a rating monthly. And if you 90 or above for three consecutive months, you get the next pay scale up. I don't know whether they're still doing that, but that's the way they were doing it. That's that time in the, but you see the third month, they can drop you to 89, then you got to start over again. So they could keep you in line. Well, I had two months of 90, and then I came back from the service. But you know that I was a veteran. I had a veteran's preference, and that automatically put 5 points on there, and they couldn't drop you more than 3 points without having a hearing. In other words, I had to have a trial. It was impossible to prove that I was unfit if that degraded me. So automatically it gave me the next rating up. Well, to make a long story short, I would have been the youngest foreman in the whole Navy Yard. I was just a young punk kid. Everybody else was up there, late 40s, before you get that far. And I figured, well, here's a good time to. I accepted the job and turned in my resignation immediately. So when I left, what vacation I had coming, I got it. That's a neat rating. And I quit. And I haven't been back since. So then I went commercial fishing for a couple of years. I went down to California, fished. I was fishing for shark liver. Made vitamins out of them. That was big business during the war. And that was a biggest money maker in commercial fishing at that time. And then in the spring, following spring, we went to the same boat and went halibut fishing. And my ankle gave me such a rough time there that I had to get off and get to him and take a steamer back home. So I quit fishing again. And went back to work in the electrical business here in the shipyards, you know, in Seattle.
Now, when you were working in the shipyards originally, you had been married?
Well, I finished my apprenticeship, and we got married in 1943, and I had just finished my apprenticeship, and we got married in May of 43, okay. And so.
What's your wife's name?
Doris.
And her last name, maiden name?
It was Carlson.
And she's Swedish.
Well, her on her dad's side is all Swede. Her mother's side is English and Irish and German and everything. Mm-hmm. She considered herself Swede, you know.
How did you meet?
Well, how did we meet? Well, they were living in a town called Palsbo, which is called Little Norway. it's a Norwegian settlement over in Kitsap County. It's on the north end of the county, and we were living in the south end of the county. But in 1935, the Carlson family left Palsbo. They bought some property, and they bought it in Olala, and they bought it right next door to where we lived. And it was during, of course, it was during, that was in 35, but 35 or 36. But when, after we got married, you asked where we met, and I said, well, it was a wartime, gas was rationed, and I couldn't go very far. She lived right next door.
It's very convenient.
Yeah, very convenient.
And what year and month were you married?
May 15th, 1943. So we got 61 years last May.
Congratulations.
Same wife, Phil.
Oh. And going back a little bit, did your parents both eventually become citizens?
Oh, yes. Well, my dad was a citizen. He became a citizen while in Alaska while we were still in Norway. But the five kids were all on that. When he was naturalized, it was five kids. But my mother came to this country, and when we came here, she went to classes. And took the test and passed it, and she was naturalized on her own.
Oh, she didn't automatically become?
No. She had to be naturalized on her own. We, as kids, minor kids, we got in on his papers. But if we were 21 or over, we would have had to do it on our own. But she did. She got her own papers. Mm-hmm. Oh.
And what did you do after the war when you went back to electronics?
Well, after the war, in 44, after I quit fishing, when anchor came in, I came to a shipyard here in Seattle, and went to a yard that did a lot of repair work for the Army transport and so forth, and I got a foreman's job, hired out as a foreman. I had the experience, and I had the clearance to install radar. I was in one of the first radar installations done in the U.S. Navy.
We're going to pause for a second.
Done on a,
okay, we're going to continue.
It wasn't done on a U.S. Navy ship. The first radar was installed on a British battleship. Mm-hmm. A British battleship was in the Bremerton Navy Yard. The Americans repaired it. It got damaged way down in Australia someplace, and they brought her all the way to Bremerton for repairs. But and radar was invented in Britain. So with the installation I worked on the Warspite, the British biggest battleship that England had. I worked on it in the Bremerton Navy Yard. And so when I went in on repairs for installation, I had, that was highly secret stuff, I mean, at that time. And I had a clearance from the Navy to work on radar. So I was able to come in a big yard and get a job as a foreman, and that yard then could take on radar installations on the Army transports, which he couldn't do without somebody. I wasn't that qualified, but I had the clearance, so somebody else were qualified to do it, but that's how I got a job. So I worked there for quite a few years, and I went to work for another outfit called the Puget Sound Bridge and Dredging, and they were a shipbuilding, and they were also construction. They did a dredging channels and so forth, and I worked as an electrician for them. And then they built the dredge, which was the biggest dredge in the world at the time. And we built it. I was an electrical foreman on the building. And then the president came down. He says, "John," he says, "this is going to go up to Alaska, and they're going to dredge Wrangell Narrows." But he says, "The dredging crew has never seen anything this big before. You know, that pump, 24-inch pipe discharge. You know, that's a lot of, that's a big pump. And you imagine the amount of horsepower. We had electric motors run on 2300 volts. I mean, there was high voltage stuff. And high horsepower, shoot. It was 3,000 horsepower in one electric motor. And they'd never seen anything that big before. I did some of the installation, but I wasn't sure I could operate it either. But I was supposed to go up and break in the crew. So I shipped out as chief engineer on the biggest dredge in the world. And I'd never been dredging before. But I went up there to break in a new crew. I thought it'd take me a couple of weeks. I was there 4 months. But I made good money at it. No doubt about it. And it was a nice dredge, and I got a lot of experience. And I came back after 4 months. I came back, and they had another job in the shipyard in the ship repair division. They gave me a job. I became superintendent of ship repair for Puget Sound Bridge and Dredging. That yard, after I left, it was sold. Lockheed Shipbuilding bought it. So I became Lockheed Shipbuilding. But anyway, I took that job, and I had that job for, I don't know, 3 or 4 years. And I decided I'm going to work I'm going to work for myself. I came out here to Ballard, and I started Hendrix Electric Incorporated. And we were in business for 42 years. And we did fishing boats, yachts. Anything else that...
And that's the job you retired from?
Yeah, I retired while I turned over to the kids. The kids now have decided that they closed that business down, and one of them is in the same business with one of my competitors. He's running this... The youngest son is running the store for one of the biggest electrical contractors, and the other one is in the water purification business. Purify water for construction outfits. You use water now, and you can't dump it back into the drains or anything. You've got to purify so it's drinkable before you can dump it. And that's big business now.
So how many children did you have?
Well, I had 3 kids, and 6 grandchildren and 2 great-grandsons.
And what are your children's names?
The oldest one is Jean, is my daughter. Stan is my oldest son, and Paul is the youngest son. Mm-hmm. Paul will be 50 years old next Monday. He's the youngest.
Well, getting back to your family and talking about their experience, did they continue when you were growing up in Washington State? Did they continue a lot of the Norwegian traditions?
Oh, yes. My family? Oh, yes, absolutely. We're part of the traditions some of the cooking and the Scandinavian cooking. My wife learned an awful lot from my mother. And there are certain delicacies that are Scandinavian, or, you know, that she takes up her certain delicacies. Norwegian lefse, I don't know if you ever heard of it.
Lefse? No. How do you spell that?
L-E-F-S-E. All it is a thin flatbread. It's you get it as nice, it's so crisp, you know, you drop it, it breaks into pieces. But and you roll it out with a rolling pin, and you bake it, and then you can stack it, and you can keep it for a whole year or two. And when you don't need it, you take it out and lay it, and you take it, sprinkle it with water. It'll soften up, and then you butter it. Put sugar and cinnamon on there, and roll it up. And that's a delicacy, and it's delicious. And there's very few people that know how to bake it.
And what are some of the other delicacies that?
Well, there's a difference. All the Scandinavian ways of cooking. You take fish. There are lots of ways besides fish. You take fish and you can grind it up, you know, and you can bake it like a loaf, or make fish cakes. Well, that's a trick. Get them right consistency. Mm-hmm. Very few people know how to do it right.
And what kind of fish would you use for this?
Well, we use a ling cod mostly. We use regular cod fish too, you know, but it's a white fish, but the ling cod works better. It's more tender, you know.
Is that a fish that you get in the Northwest?
Well, yes, it's mostly. Well, they get it on the Atlantic coast too. I don't know whether. I don't know where the ling cod is around the Atlantic. There's a fish similar to it in Norway. I don't remember what it's called it, but in other words, that's some of the things and some of the way they take a cured lamb and mutton, you know, and. That's all Scandinavian, those are the things, and the way we celebrate the holidays. I mean, I think the Scandinavians are the ones that Christmas Eve is more important than Christmas Day as a rule. That tradition is still in our family.
Now, you mentioned that you cured meats special. There was a special way to cure meats.
Well, you take a leg of lamb or something like that. You take the whole leg and you put it in a salt brine and get a good one so you know that it's cured that way. And then you hang it up and dry it, and then you can just take a knife and slice off, and you eat that. What happened when my oldest son went to high school, what they call Ballard High, he'd have a leg of lamb. He'd have it in his locker in between classes. He'd cut off a piece of that. I don't think anybody else did. Right now, they wouldn't allow that. He had that and a butcher knife in the locker. but he wanted, when my oldest son was in the service, he was in the Air Force. He was a nuclear weapons specialist. He was a master sergeant is all he got. They wanted to give him a commission. He didn't want it. He liked the people better than non-commissioned. But anyway, he was in stationed in Turkey, and asked him. He wasn't much for writing letters, but he had one of the first. He was taping. That was a little reel, you know, battery operated. He sent us a tape. And whenever he had something to say, well, he'd say it on, then he'd ship it. We had to buy a machine. They don't use that type of reel anymore, you know, little reel, you know. We'd answer him and ship it back. We used the same reel back over and over again. And anyway, we asked him what he would like anything for Christmas. Well, we sent him a package of Scandinavian cookies, and then we got a leg of lamb that had been cured and wrapped up. We sent them, both of them, to Turkey.
I guess
that leg of lamb, with the cost of buying it and shipping it, it cost me $50, pretty close. But the cookies were all crumbled up. But that leg of lamb, that was gourmet dining for him. It was.
Was it important for both your parents to become Americanized, to adopt American attitudes and customs?
Absolutely. My mother thought that she was in this country and she wanted to live like, you know, like our neighbors. So she enjoyed learning. So she didn't have any trouble learning. She learned. She was fast learning. She caught on quick.
So she was able to integrate the traditional Norwegian life and life in America.
Oh, yes. That's no problem.
And how did you feel growing up? How did you and your brothers feel? Did you feel like you were, was it easy to become an American?
Oh, yeah. We felt it was an adventure. We were looking forward to what's coming next. We were happy that we were here. So, of course, my brothers, they were all three of my brothers were older than me. They were looking forward to be big enough to get a job on a fishing boat, you know. So that's where most of the family ended up, you know.
And you mentioned that your wife is mostly Swedish in heritage. Did the different people from the different Scandinavian countries get along in the United States?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I don't think there was always a friendly rivalry with Norwegians and Swedes, but we got along fine. As a matter of fact, my dad bought property that was strictly, they were 100% Swedish, the family he bought from, and they were good neighbors. And then the people moved on the other side of us. That was where my wife's folks moved in. He was Swede, so we didn't have any trouble with the Scandinavian, with the rest of the community over I lived in was there was Norwegians, Swedes, and Swedish Finns. And that was most, there was one or two German families, but the community, there was an awful lot of Norwegians in there. And there was about, well, at Olala where I went to school, there were six or seven families that all immigrated from the same place in Norway. So, in other words, and some of them were even related. And then there were a lot of Swedes and a lot of Swedish Finns. Well, they talked Swedish, but they were born in Finland.
Was Finland always a separate country?
Oh, well, yes, but Sweden and Finland were integrated to a certain extent.
Hi, we're continuing again. We're in a classroom in the Nordic Heritage Museum, and there will be a class starting in a few minutes. So we have a little bit of the students coming in. And I wanted to ask Mr. Hendricks about his association with the museum.
Well, back in 88, there was a friend of mine that, he was a past president of the Norwegian Commercial Club. I'd known him. He was vice president of the museum board at that time. But he said, I have some stuff I have to haul. He knew that I had a fleet of trucks. He says, can you haul something? So I says, okay, Trigg, I'll come on over. And so I come over and haul some stuff for him into the museum. I'd already retired at that time, so. Well, he says, we come over here every Thursday morning, you know, and work. So I says, all right. So I came over to see what they were doing. First thing you know, I became part of the Thursday crew. And I'd been on the Thursday crew for about a year or so. When Trigg, when the guys that were running it, Trigg Jorgensen, came in, he said, well, he says, one of the board members just retired. He says, would you like to take his place? So, okay. I says, I'll take his place. And I did, and I thought, well, he had only about a year left on his term. Well, the year was up. They had an election. They elected me. They wanted me to another term, and I ended up 11 years on the board. And I decided the next time, I said, that's enough. Let somebody else do it. They need new blood. I think I was doing them a favor by getting off of the board.
And now you're a volunteer here?
Well, I never quit being a volunteer. I come over on Thursday morning for the coffee break. That's it, crew. But I'm here, I'm a consultant. In other words, electrical problems and so forth, yes. Mm-hmm. I come over and I'll help when needed. And we do have a retired electrical engineer that's supposed to be on the Thursday crew. He took the day off today, but he's supposed to be here. Mm-hmm. But that's mainly what my volunteer is for.
And what's the main mission of the Nordic Heritage Museum?
Well, it's to maintain and continue our heritage for... I think that's... almost all heritage museum art for that same purpose. And we don't want to forget. We don't want our great-grandkids to forget it.
And one of the things that they do here is the language classes.
Language classes.
They have exhibits downstairs.
And you have exhibits and they have language classes. And I assume you've been through some of the rooms, you know, you have the Norway room and the Swedish room and the Danish room and so forth. And the fishing room up there. Part of that in the fishing room, part of that gear, the halibut gear My brother donated part of that, so.
And what are you most proud of in your life?
Well, I don't know. Proud of the fact that I've got a good family, and I've proud of the fact I think that I've done some good in being here. I've enjoyed being a volunteer. I don't think that the museum owes me anything for what I put in, because I've gotten my money's worth out of it. That's my feeling. And any volunteer that doesn't feel that way isn't a very good volunteer, I don't think.
And, now, do you feel mostly American, or do you feel part American and part Norwegian, or?
No, I feel I'm American, but I'm proud of my heritage. I'm proud of being a Norwegian. I'm not a bit ashamed of being a Norwegian.
And you've been back there a number of times.
Well, yes. I still have lots of relatives in Norway, all on my dad's side. On my mother's side, they all came to this country, but on my dad's side, I had lots of relatives.
And how did it feel going back? Did it feel good?
The first time we went back, to where I came, where my mother came from. And it was the middle of the week, it was during the summertime, when everybody is, you know, they were in the farming community and so forth. I mean, they were farmers and fishermen, but they had farms, and everybody is working on farm. You know, the day we came, wife and I came, it was like a holiday. It's surprising. I didn't expect anything like that. I don't know how many people lived there. It was 150 people that greeted us. And we hadn't been there for 43 years since I'd been in there. And I mean, that was amazing. So, then my wife looked at the scenery there, and she says, "Why in the world did you ever leave?" Well, it is a beautiful country. It's hard to see. I'll tell you, the west coast of Ireland is probably the closest to the west coast of Norway. So you don't have the fjords in Ireland that we have in Norway. But otherwise, it's beautiful country.
Now, do you remember? Well, are you still fluent in?
In Norwegian?
Norwegian, can you?
Well, I can make myself understood, and but the big problem I have, as a 10-year-old, I didn't have the vocabulary that, you know, that you'd have by the time you're fully grown. And so those words I learned, and it was hard to go back and get the vocabulary. So in other words, but I don't have any problem understanding. I can go to Norway or Sweden, and I can understand what they're talking about. I have no problem, and I can make myself understood. But I found that when I go back there, people that are younger than me are way better at English than I am at their language. So in other words, if you're traveling in almost any European country, I can go to Germany, and of course I don't speak any German, but the kids, most kids that are under 50 in Germany talk fluent English.
Can you say anything, a saying, a proverb, or a prayer, or something like that in Norwegian?
Well,
for the tape?
Oh, for the tape? Yeah.
Hello.
Yeah. It can snakke norsk. I'm speaking Norwegian. It's snakke norsk. Yeah. So there, I'm not that good on Norwegian, but I can understand what anybody says, and I can.
Mm-hmm. Hiya, Peggy.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much. I want to thank John Hendricks for giving us this interview, and to Marianne Forsblad for arranging it. And anything else you'd like to say before we finish?
No, I think I've enjoyed talking with you and answering what I'm able to answer. I'm not so sure that you gained much information from me. I'm not that good at. I don't have that much information to pass out. But
we covered a lot of ground.
It was covered a lot of ground. And I appreciate that. I do have one question. You get this tape. When I had the interview, they made tape. They made copies.
Yeah, we'll send you.
You'll send me a copy.
Yeah. Okay.
I would really appreciate that.
Oh yes, definitely. Okay. Well, I'm going to sign off now. The Norwegian class is going to start pretty soon. Mm-hmm. So this is Kevin Daly. I'm at the Nordic Heritage Museum with John Hendricks in Seattle, Washington State. It's October 21st, 2004, and I'm signing off. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oop.